Lecture 27, The War's Early Years and the Great Plague.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back. In this lecture, we're going to examine the first few years of the Peloponnesian War from 431, when it broke out, to 427. That year, 427, marks the end of the revolt of Mytilene on the island of Lesbos, off the coast of Asia Minor. And the speeches of Cleon and a certain Diodotus to the Athenian assembly that put forward alternate punishments for the people of Mytilene. Thucydides, who gives us these speeches, uses them to critique the nature of Athenian imperialism at this time. So these speeches are very important for giving us a glimpse into what the people are thinking about. Before we start on all of this, let's consider the resources of the two sides at the beginning of the war. There's no question that the Athenians were odds-on favourite to win this war. They had an annual pharos of 1,000 talents from their allies. And they had a further 1,000 talents in reserve in the league treasury. They also had about 13,000 first-class hoplites and a reserve force of around 16,000-17,000 or so. Most importantly, they had the largest navy in Greece, so they had plenty of money and plenty of manpower. The Spartan resources were also good, but they didn't come anywhere near the Athenians. The Peloponnesian League had a powerful land army of around 40,000 hoplites, so it could certainly put more men into the field than the Athenians could. But the Spartans had no annual income from their allies because, if you remember, they would levy income only in times of war. That meant that they had no financial reserves at their disposal, unlike the Athenians. Moreover, Sparta didn't have a navy. Its chief naval power was Corinth. But even as late as 432, or indeed 431, Corinth was still recovering from its naval defeat at Athenian hands off Corcyra in 433. If you remember, this was one of the causes of the Peloponnesian War. Even more significant, though, was Sparta's Achilles heel. And that is, of course, the threat of revolt from the Helots. As we know, the Spartans were reliant on these people. And this was something that didn't affect any other Greek state. Now, bearing all of these factors in mind, we'd probably put a few dollars or drachmas on the Athenians if there was a bet as to who would win the war. But you know what? We would lose. The first 10 years of the war, from 431 to 421, are called the Archidamian War. And this name is taken after the Spartan king Archidamus. He led a series of invasions into Attica that was supposed to be on an annual basis. In 421, that's at the end of the Archidamian War period, hostilities came to an end with the Peace of Nicias. And it was called this after the Athenian general Nicias, who brokered the peace. However, this peace of Nicias, lasted for only a short time, 2 or 3 years or so, before warfare again broke out. Now, you might then think that we're dealing with two separate wars, one from 431 to 421, and then the other one from about 418 or so to 404. But Thucydides was right to see that the war between Athens and Sparta was one long one, and that it was punctuated only by a short hiatus, after the Peace of Nicias and then the resumption of hostilities. So that's why we give the dates of the Peloponnesian War as 431 to 404, as if there was no hiccup in it. In May of 431, Archidamus of Sparta led a Spartan force into Attica in the first of what were expected to be a series of annual invasions by the Spartans. The intention was to devastate the crops of Attica and in doing so to lure the Athenian army into battle. Now, this was actually a good plan on the part of the Spartans. And indeed, this plan formed the basis of their war strategy. And the basis of their war strategy, at least in this period, was to fight a pitched land battle. Why? Because Sparta had superior numbers of hoplites, and the Spartans were, of course, better trained than the Athenian soldiers. So the idea was that the Athenians would see their crops being devastated, crops like olives, grapes, any corn that was grown in Attica, seeing these devastated and burned, and in rage would lock and load and rush out to fight the Spartans. In other words, they give in to their emotions, and no one ever fights properly when a person is ruled by emotion rather than reason. The odds were that the Spartans would inflict a defeat on the Athenians, and as a result, they would bring the war to a quick conclusion. Now, I find it interesting that the Spartans thought that land invasions of Attica would be enough to win the war. And they thought this mainly because they were a land power, not a naval one. I find this an example of their myopia, don't you think? I mean, there was still the Athenian navy to contend with. Athens boasted the largest navy in the Greek world, as we know. In a land battle, it's hard to use a navy. Someone has to carry those ships. It's not very effective. And I think that's why the Spartans wanted to fight the Athenians on land. And they didn't think beyond this. Pericles recognized the Spartan strategy. He was savvy. We've talked about Pericles. We know he's well able to suss out what the other side is thinking and react accordingly. Since Athens' strength and therefore its advantage lay in its navy, Pericles decided on a three-pronged strategy to overcome Sparta. His aim was that because Athens could receive supplies into the Piraeus, the port of Athens, and transport them safely into the city behind the long walls, then the Spartans would eventually get sick of a protracted siege and agree to peace. So let's go over Pericles' three-pronged strategy. First, the first prong, as I call it. The Athenians were to resist a land battle with the Spartans at all costs. Pericles knew that the war might indeed be over with the Spartans victorious in it if the Athenians fought a battle with them and lost. Okay, the Athenians defeated the Persians at the Battle of Marathon. But we note that they really only defeated the Persians because Athenian infantry was better than Persian, and Marathon was an infantry battle. The Persian cavalry was not deployed. Spartan hoplites, on the other hand, were immensely better trained and better fighters than the Athenians because the Spartan soldier was a soldier all the time. Remember, the helots gave the Spartans the leisure time to train in the army continually, unlike the Athenians, most of whom, the hoplites, were traders or wealthier farmers. So in a pitched land battle, the odds did lie with the Spartans, and Pericles knew that. Remember also the part that the Spartans had played in the land battle at Plataea. So how Pericles managed this, in other words, how he was able to persuade the Athenians not to rush out and fight this land battle when they saw the Spartans on Attic soil, was by bringing the country population into Athens itself. And he then ordered preparations for a siege, regardless of the damage that the Spartans caused in Attica. Now, I personally don't think Pericles brought everyone throughout Attica into the city. I think that would be an impossible feat. More likely, he brought in those that live closer to the city, perhaps in the city and coastal regions, for example, because presumably the Spartans wouldn't march over Attic mountains and take on farmers in the easternmost regions of Attica. So, as I said, we're probably talking about the people living in the city region, obviously, as well as those living in the coast, and perhaps also the inland regions that were closer to Athens and to the north of Athens, on the top of Attica, on the border with Boeotia. Pericles' the second prong in his three-prong strategy, was that the Athenians were not to increase their territory while the war continued. In other words, they were not to expand their empire. Now, this makes perfect sense, as getting engaged in another area would mean diverting manpower, and this was not the wisest move if the Spartans were going to invade Attica every year. It would also mean spending money that they otherwise wouldn't need to. Now again, with no idea about how long the war might last, and with the economy taking a hit as it was not prudent to waste financial reserves. So Pericles is thinking about this as well. The third and final part of his three-pronged strategy called for an Athenian fleet of 100 ships to sail every year on a ravaging mission around the Peloponnese. The idea was to harass the Spartan war effort. Now, this expedition, called the Periplus, a Greek word that means sailing around, this expedition was meant to divert Sparta's attention to its own borders. Now, you might be thinking that an enemy presence off the Peloponnesian coastline wouldn't worry the Spartans too much. I mean, after all, Sparta was inland, and it could call on the allies and the Peloponnesian League for help if, unexpectedly, the Athenians landed on Peloponnesian soil and marched to Sparta. And I would agree with you if you're thinking this way. But, and there's always a but, isn't there? What state is in the southeast part of the Peloponnese? Answer, Messenia. And who lives in it? Answer, Helots. We're doing a pop quiz, aren't we? How exciting. And could the Athenian fleet land a force in Messenia and perhaps try to encourage the Helots to revolt? Altogether now, yes, it could. In fact, this Athenian move will happen in 425, as we'll see. So the Periplus was very clever on Pericles' part, and it would have worried the Spartans enormously, given their reliance on the Helots. It's hardly a surprise that the resulting overcrowding in the city, plus the Spartans' devastation of the land, made Pericles unpopular. The people in the city were forced to live everywhere once the houses were full. They lived on the street. They lived along the city walls. They lived in temples. They even lived in the long walls that stretched to the Piraeus. However, it's a sign of Pericles' oratorical prowess in the assembly that he was able to prevent the Athenians from marching out to do battle with Sparta. And so, the first year of the war was somewhat inconsequential. Archidamus devastated the Athenian crops, and the Athenians in the city would have seen the smoke from the fires quite easily. But nevertheless, they remained within the city walls, and they didn't engage the Spartans in battle. At the end of the first year of the war, Pericles delivered his funeral oration over those Athenians who died in it. Now, it's very hard to see who would have died in the first year of the war or where they would have died. Perhaps a possible area was around Megara, because after the Spartans left Attica at the end of the campaigning season, the Athenians made a quick attack on the place, a quick attack on Megara. However, it was a tradition in Athens to have this type of epideictic or showcase speech during a war. A funeral oration belongs to a genre of oratory called epideictic or showpiece oratory. And Thucydides tells us that the Athenians were unique among the Greeks in having this tradition of a prominent statesman being selected by the people to deliver this solemn speech over the dead from that year in the war. And we talked about Pericles' funeral oration in a previous lecture and how it became almost a model for the Gettysburg Address and President Clinton's D-Day anniversary speech. Archidamus reinvaded Attica at the start of the next campaigning season in 430. Then something happened that nobody had expected. The Great Plague broke out. This probably broke out because of overcrowding in the city and a lack of hygiene. And once the plague struck, it tore through these overcrowded city areas like wildfire. Bodies that fell into the wells quickly polluted the water supply, causing yet more disease and death. To this day, the actual disease is not known, although typhus and bubonic are the most likely. I have seen every possible disease put forward to explain the plague. I've even read an article that suggests it could be toxic shock syndrome. So far, the one thing I haven't seen is AIDS, but I'm sure that'll come. Thucydides himself caught the plague, but he recovered from it, one of the few to do so. And he describes its symptoms. He describes the pain he felt. Things like bleeding from the mouth, vomiting continuously, skin that when you touched it felt like fire, an inability to sleep, and diarrhea so severe that it could kill a person. Not very nice at all. The common opinion is that the plague came from the east, transported by rats, or rather fleas on rats, that came on ships that exported and import goods from the east. One of my students once corrected me on this when I said, the plague was probably brought by rats. No, she said, fleas on rats. So she knows better than I do. It's rather like the Black Death in medieval Europe, isn't it? Which I think was transported in much the same way. And it was just as deadly as the medieval Black Death, because about one quarter of the people cooped up in Athens died from the plague. One quarter of the entire Athenian citizenry. And it took something like 15 years for manpower losses to be recouped. Now, Thucydides' graphic account of the plague also captures much of the loss of morale and lawlessness that it brought. The Greeks, for example, took great care to bury their dead, because this was the expectation in the eyes of the gods. Moreover, if you didn't bury someone, that person's soul was fated to wander in Hades for eternity, which is quite a long time. But Thucydides tells us that while the plague was wreaking havoc in the city, corpses were left unburied in the streets and even in the temples. Pyres that were built to burn corpses were appropriated by other people who used them to bury their own dead. In normal society, this sort of thing would have been reprehensible, especially leaving dead bodies in temples. That's pollution. So there was a tremendous falling away from religion. And we can hardly blame the people for this, because they must have wondered what on earth was going on. And then, What have we done to displease the gods so much? And that led to lawlessness and a complete lack of morality. Believing that the gods had deserted them and that on the next day they could die, people went on a rampage of looting and raping to the utter disregard of society. So again, in the reaction to the plague, we can see how the Athenians accepted the role that the gods played in their lives. They thought this was divine. And then they thought, we've got nothing to lose, so let's just do whatever we want. Tomorrow, we're likely to die. Athenian society became anarchic then. Now, the Athenians wanted to sue for peace, and we can't blame them. But Pericles persuaded them otherwise. Even in these dire times, he was able to persuade the masses not to appeal for peace. And when the plague broke out in Athens, the Peloponnesian army withdrew back home. It no doubt wanted to steer well clear of becoming infected. So that was a bit of a minor plus, and it worked in Pericles' favour. However, a great blow was about to fall on Athens. And that was in 429, the next year, when Pericles died of the plague. And his death opens the door now to the new politicians coming to the forefront in Athenian political life, the non-noble demagogues, of whom Cleon is the first. Now, by 428 or so, the plague had run its course. Its effect on Athens may have had a bearing on the revolt of Mytilene on the island of Lesbos. And this revolt broke out in 428, and it's what I want to discuss in the last part of this lecture. Mytilene was a major naval power, and it would seem that it was finding Athenian authority and having to pay tribute to the city rather irksome. It wanted to have its autonomy back, complete autonomy. Now, despite being on their knees, which they were, the Athenians managed to deploy a fleet that blockaded Mytilene. And to offset a shortage of money, the Athenians raised the allied tribute, the allied pharos. These measures were perhaps the work of Cleon, the first of the so-called rhetores, who, as we say, come to prominence in the vacuum left by Pericles. Now, Mytilene capitulated after a pretty lengthy siege in 427. Afterwards, the Athenians held an assembly to decide what to do. It was decided on the motion of Cleon to kill all the male Mytileneans and to sell the women and children into slavery. And so the Athenian assembly gave orders that a trireme carrying this terrible order should be sent to the commander of the Athenian force at Mytilene, and off it went. Now, this punishment was terrible, sure, but it was understandable. Technically, the oath of eternal allegiance meant that no ally had the right to leave the Delian League. And at this critical time for Athens, given the plague, we can understand why it was even more important to set an example so that other allies didn't revolt. But overnight, Thucydides tells us, the Athenians had a change of heart. So the next day, they called another assembly meeting to debate the punishment again. Now, apparently, the same speakers from the previous day spoke again on this second day. Thucydides gives us the speeches of Cleon and his opponent Diodotus from this second debate. Cleon, for example, said it was necessary to make an example of what would happen to any revolting ally to stop future revolts. These, he argued, would affect Athenian security and prosperity. The Athenians, he said, had an empire that they had acquired by force, and they needed to hold on to it in any way they could. He even calls the Athenian Empire a tyranny when he says, and I quote here, "Your empire is a tyranny exercised over subjects who do not like it, and they are always plotting against you. You will not make them obey you by injuring your own interests in order to do them a favor. Your leadership depends on superior strength and not on any goodwill of theirs. He urged the people not to go back on what they decided on the previous day. And in fact, he berated them for even thinking about changing their minds now. Cleon was opposed by a man named Diodotus. He agreed with Cleon that the people of Mytilene had done wrong and that they should be punished. He also agreed with Cleon that Athens did head an empire and that it needed to maintain that headship. But he advised the people that in the long run, it would be better for Athens if only the ringleaders of the revolt were executed. As Diodotus said, future revolts were bound to happen. And if people realized that there was no way out, that those who, say, were against a revolt from the outset or who changed their minds as it was going on, if these people realized that they were going to be put to death at the end of the revolt anyway, then everyone would be fighting tooth and nail to the bitter end. That would harm Athens far more so than being seen as a hegemon, a leader that tries to rule in a fair and equitable manner. The Athenians were swayed by Diodotus' speech, and the previous day's decision was reversed. Orders to spare the Mytileneans were sent on another trireme that rode as fast as possible, and it arrived in the nick of time. And as a result, only the ringleaders, about 1,000 of them, were executed. Now, as I said, Thucydides gives us the speeches of Cleon and Diodotus from this second debate. In our brief discussion of Thucydides in our previous lecture, we said that his speeches are unlikely to be verbatim. It's more likely that while he gives us roughly the gist of what was said, he uses speeches in his narrative as vehicles for the attitudes of the time and even his own thoughts on things. It's a bit like a commentary within his narrative. In the case of the Mytilene debate, Thucydides is giving us a debate on the nature of Athenian imperialism, something that was clearly in the minds of the people at this time. Cleon's attitude is that since the Athenians have an empire, they must maintain leadership of it at all costs. They have to set examples where necessary, no matter how brutal. And his might is right policy is in contrast to Diodotus' policy of moderation. While Diodotus doesn't excuse the fact that Mytilene should not have revolted, he argues that Athens should exercise rule fairly rather than savagely. In this way, their allies will be reconciled to Athenian leadership. In Thucydides, Cleon comes over as brutal, lacking political savvy, and in fact plain wrong, and that's because he shouldn't be advising the Athenians. But that's because he's a non-noble. But as well as this social snobbery, Thucydides is writing after he's been exiled from Athens, probably at the instigation of Cleon. So much for Thucydides' objectivity, eh? Really speaking, Cleon's approach was no different, no less brutal, than that advocated by Pericles on other occasions. A town of Histiaea on Euboea suffered mass enslavement and death on Pericles' orders. And think also about the Megarian decree, which spelled economic ruin and hence disaster for the Megarians. Thucydides does say that this decree, this Megarian decree, led to the Peloponnesian War, but he doesn't criticize Pericles for it. He can't, because Pericles came from the right side of the tracks. Anyway, in these speeches, we glimpse an insight into what contemporary Athenians thought about how Athens should rule its empire. These speeches are a real window into what people at the time are thinking, and Thucydides is echoing that. The leaders of many imperial powers throughout history would have done well to reflect on how Thucydides has Diodotus criticize Cleon's arguments, eh? Then again, can we really criticise Cleon's brand of imperialism, at least at this time, given that the Athenians had just suffered the plague and needed to keep its empire intact at all costs? Well, while warfare continued in Greece over the next few years, the next significant event in the Archidamian War that I want to deal with is the Pylos-Sphacteria campaign of 425 to 424. And we start with that in our next lecture. And we will take events down to the Peace of Nicias in 421, in other words, to the end of the Archidamian War. Thank you very much.